Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. I'm Caroline Bryant, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this webinar titled Rockets, Pagers, and Targeted Strikes, Law of War Issues in the Israeli-Hezbollah Conflict. Our panelists today are Dr. Peter Berkowitz and Professor Diane Desierto. Peter Berkowitz is the Tad and Diane Taub Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, Stanford University. He formerly served as the Director of the State Department's Policy Planning Staff, Executive Secretary of the Department's Commission on Inalienable Rights, and Senior Advisor to the Secretary of State. Professor Diane Desierto holds a joint appointment in the Keough School of Global Affairs and at Notre Dame Law School, where she is Professor of Law and LLM Faculty Director. She's a faculty fellow in the Keough School's Clow Institute for Civil and Human Rights, Kellogg Institute of International Studies, Liu Institute for Asian and Asian Studies, and many other appointments. She's also co-principal investigator of the Notre Dame Reparations Design and Compliance Lab. Our moderator today is Daniel West. Dan is the managing director at SCF Partners. Prior to joining the private sector, Dan served as an infantry officer in the United States Marine Corps. If you'd like to learn more about today's speakers and moderator, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. After our speaker gives their presentations, we will turn to you, the audience, for questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. We will do our best to get to as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers, not the Federalist Society. With that, Dan, thank you so much for joining us, and the floor is yours.
Thanks, Caroline, and good afternoon, everybody, and thank you for joining us. Today, we'll discuss the conflict between Israel and Hezbollah, which erupted most recently when Hezbollah joined Hamas's attack on Israel in solidarity by launching rockets and artillery one day after the massacre on October 7th, 2023. Fierce fighting raged on this northern front for much of the past year, with large segments of the population displaced from their homes for months and tragic civilian casualties. We've also seen remarkable tactical innovations from the Israelis, including the use of exploding pagers and walkie-talkies to degrade Hezbollah's command structure. Today, we're fortunate to have Peter and Diane here with us to provide an expert view on these events, the principles of the law of armed conflict, and the prospects for regional peace. So let's jump in. And Peter, let's start with you with what might be a difficult challenge in a short time window here. We have a generalist audience at the Federalist Society, and we're hoping you can give us a quick high-level overview on the history of this conflict between Hezbollah and Israel to help us understand what was the status quo before October 7th.
Happy to do so. And I want to say thank you to you, Dan, to Caroline hosting it, and Diane for participating in the conversation. So the origins of Hezbollah lie in the early 1980s. Summer of 1982, Israel invaded southern Lebanon in order to drive out the Palestinian Liberation Organization led by Yasser Arafat. Hezbollah formed as part of the Iranian axis of resistance to then drive Israel out of southern Lebanon. But Hezbollah had more than one enemy in Lebanon. It also had as an enemy the United States of America. One of the first notorious deeds of Hezbollah was the destruction of a Marine barracks in 1983 in Beirut, which killed 241 American troops and 50-some French military and civilian personnel. Eventually, the Israelis did withdraw from the southern Lebanon security belt. It was in the summer of 2000. But Hezbollah, whose name means Party of God, remained intact because they had another mission. They had other missions besides driving first the United States and Israel out of Lebanon. One of those missions was to destroy Israel. Another mission was to impose Sharia law on all of Lebanon. After Israel withdrew in 2000, Hezbollah continued to arm, to acquire rockets and missiles. In 2006, Hezbollah ambushed Israeli troops along the Lebanon-Israel border. Hezbollah killed three, took two Israeli soldiers captive. This triggered the first Lebanon war, 2006, a 34-day war. The first 32 days, Israel attacked from the air mostly. The last 2 days, a ground campaign. This was a very significant war for a number of reasons. In the end, Israel inflicted punishing blows on Hezbollah, but the civilian population of Lebanon also suffered. Hassan Nasrallah, who is the leader of Hezbollah, both as militia and political party, said after the war, if he had known how Israel would respond, he would not have launched the war. But it's significant for another reason in the context of the conflicts in the Middle East. Namely, it was the war that brought into focus that the fundamental source of instability in the Middle East actually is not Israel or the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The fundamental source of instability is the Sunni-Shia conflict. How did we know that? Because for the first time in Middle East history, in 2006, three Arab states condemned not Israel when Israel found itself entangled in a war with an Arab party, but condemned the Arab side, that is, Egypt, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia. Sunni states condemned Shia Hezbollah, which began to reveal how important that break in the Middle East, that rift is in the Middle East. The war ended in 2006. Israel enjoyed relative quiet on its borders from 2006 until October 7th, or you could say October 8th, 2023, the day after the massacres. But this was deceptive, and I will end here, was deceptive because all during this period, Iran was funding and arming Hezbollah, such that over this almost 20-year period, although there was relative quiet on the northern border, Iran acquired something like 150,000 rockets, precision-guided rockets, and missiles, along with an arsenal of drones. In addition to that, the most massive supply of projectiles belonging to a non-state military in the world. Hezbollah had also built tunnels that extend from southern Lebanon into Israel. They had drawn up invasion plans for southern Israel. In fact, so big was the actual threat that on the morning of October 7th, Israel directed thousands of troops, not to the south where Hamas had attacked it, but to the north, where Israel understood itself to be extremely vulnerable to Hezbollah attacks. My mandate was to take us to October 7th. I'll stop there.
Oh, so that's a great segue, Peter. So Diane, given that context, let's move forward now to October 8th. So October 7th happens, October 8th comes, Hezbollah launches rocket and artillery attacks into Israel. Israel begins to respond. We've seen bitter condemnations from the international community against Israel for the civilian casualties that have occurred and against Hezbollah for hiding among the populace, some saying they've used them as human shields. Can you talk us through the key principles of the law of armed conflict as it applies to these events? In a situation where an armed group hides behind civilians, what does the law of armed conflict require of a just combatant? And who bears the burden of responsibility for suffering that ensues in a situation like that?
Thank you, Daniel, and thank you, Caroline and Peter, as well for this discussion. And my thanks to the FedSoc for organizing a discussion on this topic. There are three general principles that apply in international humanitarian law, the first being a principle of distinction, distinguishing between combatants as well as civilians. Those that can be legitimate military targets are those that are actively participating in the hostilities, either as combatants or as persons directly participating in hostilities. Civilian objects, as well as civilians themselves, ought to be protected from hostilities and thus should not be the subject of targeting.
you cannot have indiscriminate attacks as indicated in the additional protocol 1 to the Geneva Conventions. A whole cascade of prohibitions exist insofar as to reinforce the principle of distinction to regulate the laws of armed conflict. That's just one of the principles. The second principle, of course, is proportionality. And we see this especially in the nature and character of how attacks are conducted. If an attack is conducted that results in the incidental loss of life, additional protocol 1 to the Geneva Conventions requires that it should not be excessive in relation to what the concrete and direct military advantages that's anticipated from that attack. And usually, at least based on the commentaries as well as jurisprudence on the subject matter, the assessment of that direct military advantage is a subjective assessment dependent on all the intelligence available to the military commander that orders the attack. The third principle that applies here is also the principle of precautions. So in additional protocol 1, precautions in attack require as much as possible that the means and methods that are chosen to conduct an attack or in the pursuit of hostilities within, say, an international armed conflict is the most feasible possible means to minimize the incidental loss of civilian life. So all told, those three cornerstone principles of international humanitarian law, the laws of armed conflict, govern here. Human shields are particularly an interesting phenomenon in the growing civilian presence in conflict, or commentators among legal scholars call it the civilianization of conflict, where often there is what used to be a clear distinction between combatants that openly demonstrate their affiliation with a state party to the international armed conflict will appropriately conduct and identify themselves as such. The human shields problem is squarely prohibited, at least the use of human shields is squarely prohibited under international humanitarian law, precisely because it violates the principle of distinction. So no party to a conflict is permitted to use human shields, first and foremost, separately from the prohibitions under international humanitarian law and how this will constitute a war crime, even under the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, that also is separately considered as a war crime, the use of human shields. But the challenge is not all human shields are the same shield. It requires a lot of evaluation at a point in time in operation to determine if the human shield really is a civilian or potentially a voluntary human shield for a combatant. At which point in time, when you're trying to evaluate the conduct of that human shield, is the human shield really a civilian or really a person directly participating in hostilities? And that's a very fact-intensive test. The presumption, however, in international humanitarian law is if in case of doubt, the person must be presumed to be civilian. So much rests on the conduct of the parties to the hostilities themselves. In the first place, there's a continuing prohibition. It is a war crime. You're not permitted to use human shields. But for the other party to the conflict who is confronted with the human shield in the theater of operation, there's distinct responsibility to ensure that attack, howsoever it will be conducted, will always try to observe distinction, proportionality, as well as precautions, especially when a human shield is involved. So all parties bear responsibility.
So Peter, Diane mentioned these principles, proportionality, distinction, and precaution. Could you touch on these and maybe talk a bit about what is at stake for Israelis who live in the north? Have Israel's attacks been proportional to the goal sought on their behalf? Do you feel that Israel has made sufficient efforts at distinction between combatants and civilians? And then how would you score Hezbollah on the other side on the principles that Diane mentioned?
Let's start with Hezbollah because that's an easier case. They're a complete failure. Hezbollah does not distinguish between combatants and civilians and does not distinguish themselves from other civilians. They fight from within civilian areas. From October 8th, until the ceasefire a little more than a month ago. Hezbollah has been raining down indiscriminately rockets on northern Israel, such that around 80,000 Israelis had to evacuate their homes. There were no military targets along this northern belt. You can't say that Hezbollah failed to balance between anticipated military advantage against expected collateral damage to civilians and civilian infrastructure, because damage to civilians and civilian infrastructure was the whole point of their plan. Finally, it's on the Hezbollah question. There's no question of distinguishing what really in Hezbollah's case, whether someone is a human shield, the extent to which they're human shield. Their whole strategy is predicated on the use of human shields. Hezbollah's rockets and missiles and drones are stored in the villages and towns, heavily in southern Lebanon, but through all of Lebanon. They launch rockets and missiles from in and around schools, houses, apartment buildings, mosques, and so on. So it's a whole strategy of using human shields, and it's designed to put Israel in an impossible position. If Israel defends itself, civilian collateral damage is inevitable. And we in the West will be quick to condemn Israel, partly because we forget the balancing test that is at the core of all the laws of war. Well, the laws of war that Diane so nicely summarized reflect a single imperative. And that single imperative is balance, military necessity, and humanitarian responsibility. Extraordinarily hard to do when the military decides, contrary to the laws of war, to fight in and among civilians and target civilians. As for the Israelis, the Israelis in targeting rockets, missiles, missile launchers, and drones have no choice but to target target installations that are near, under civilian infrastructure. So the question would be, given that this is going to be a subjective assessment, to what extent, using legitimate means, have Israelis, to the extent possible, minimized collateral damage consistent with accomplishing legitimate military aims? And the truth is, I think, we cannot determine that until we at least look at Israeli rules of engagement, and until we at least understand the constellation of military necessities that Israel faced. While there will always be bad actions in war, even the best militaries will push the outside of the envelope, no doubt specific crimes will be identified. I remain confident that under these extraordinary circumstances, with which few armies have ever encountered, the Israeli record is not worse than any army of a rights-protecting democracy in dealing with terrorists who use human shields freely as part of their strategy and who themselves indiscriminately target civilians on the other side.
So, Diane, let's turn then to what was, I think, indisputably the most sensational event in this conflict, which was the embedding of explosive material within pagers and within walkie-talkies used by Hezbollah's command structure. Those were detonated in September of last year. The attack sparked controversy and praise. So many praise the operation. Some example quotations are a masterclass in covert action, a modern day Trojan horse. One analyst called it Operation Grim Beeper. And more than just the sensation, there was an argument, and I'll pass on arguments on both sides. The quotation from one analyst was, the operation foiled Hezbollah's human shield tactics. Hezbollah, like Hamas, places the public between it and the Israel Defense Forces. These terror groups are secure in the knowledge that Westerners will blame civilian deaths not on the terrorists, but on Israel. But the thinking observer can see clearly that these are clean kills, as clean as one can possibly imagine in war, end quote. On the other hand, there have been condemnations. The Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights issued a press release that called the operation, quote, a terrifying violation of international law, and said that the explosions could constitute war crimes of murder. Others, including U.S. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, have suggested that the devices were prohibited under the law of war as booby traps. And it's been reported that some children were injured when those devices detonated. So, Diane, can you help us understand the legal issues involved in that operation? And in your view, were these strikes lawful, or can we tell at this point?
Thanks, Daniel, and thanks, Peter, for the really great context to the complexity of this kind of characterization. So one thing that we have to be clear about at the outset is that the matter of the legality or illegality of the use of detonating devices, the beepers and the radios, are still pending investigation at the United Nations. So what are being asserted as facts or claimed as alleged facts behind the use of this technology still remains fairly in dispute. Based on what we know, we don't know how, because it's not as if Israel disclosed how the technology operates, and neither has there been any public sort of discussion of what the nature is of the attack itself and how the explosions occurred. What we do know is that there were about 32 people killed. There were approximately 3,000 persons who were injured, including two children, a diplomat, medical personnel, civilians, and that there were also affected persons who were specifically maimed, like, you know, who got eye injuries as a result of the explosions. The explosions occurred, several of them in public areas, some of them in isolated areas. So it's hard to aggregate them all as just one attack, which is why you have to evaluate the legality of each and every single explosion as it was triggered, howsoever it was triggered, under the technology that was used, which is why I hesitate to call it a booby trap at this point in time under the definition of Protocol 2 to the Convention on Certain Conventional Weapons. Because a booby trap presupposes that there's no direct intervention, like you were performing ordinary functions, next thing you know, the thing explodes or the thing detonates. There's a prohibition against other forms of devices that are deployed that require additional steps before that detonation takes place. And the distinction sort of matters here, because much as both types are prohibited, it does go into the question of how indiscriminate was the attack. What intelligence did Israel have at the time with respect to the relative proximity of the person, the proportionality, who was holding the detonating device, the proportionality of the direct military advantage to be gained from that attack, whether that person was a combatant or a person directly participating in hostilities, and if there was going to be loss of civilian life, was it disproportionate? So, and were there any other precautions that Israel took at that time? That's if we're only looking at it from the lens of the laws of armed conflict, the laws of war. Of course, other forms of law and international law also do apply. So international human rights law protections for children, the Vienna Convention protections for diplomatic relations, for example, would protect the persons of diplomats to a certain degree, right? So the assertions we're hearing in the news, that's why I hesitate to make any hard and fast characterizations at this point, because it's not entirely clear yet, much as what's obvious to us is the harm and the injury that was caused, which could certainly be the basis, say, for alleged violations of international human rights treaties and obligations with respect to children, obligations with respect to, say, women, or obligations with respect to persons who were injured, right, who experienced physical injury or who died in the process. With respect to the laws of war, it's not as straightforward as the news might suggest, which is why, to me, I need more information on how this entire operation was conducted, how each target was selected, in order to make the concrete assessment of was this really as indiscriminate as people thought? Was there actually a military advantage to be gained by targeting X person? And was it disproportionate? To what extent did Israel, you know, raise precautions? That's the kind of thing that's still pending in a real investigation on the ground. And the UN is still doing that. I mean, the experts who have raised their concerns were understandably human rights experts within their mandates who were talking about the loss of civilian life. But with respect to the laws of armed conflict, there hasn't been a definitive assessment yet. It's still pending investigation.
And the fog of war obviously obscures a lot of the facts that would be helpful in that regard. Peter, anything you would weigh in on the Beeper operation?
Yes, thanks. First, I want to say that I admire Diane's caution and admonition for us that we should withhold judgment until all the facts are gathered. That's rarely done, but weighing law of war questions sometimes, this is one of those cases, can be fact intensive. But there are some things we do know, even as the investigation is unfolding, and they help us make sense of other battlefield facts. One, we know that lawful combatants must wear fixed and distinct uniforms. They have to carry their arms openly, act under the command of a responsible leader, and they themselves must obey the laws of war. These are law of war obligations. Hezbollah does not regard itself subject to any of that. They do not feel compelled to wear uniforms. They do not carry their arms openly, and they certainly do not consider themselves subject to the laws of war. So the challenge for Israel, and one of the questions in determining proportionality and legitimate means is, how do you deal with an adversary which itself openly repudiates the laws of war? That makes Israel's targeting decisions very, very complex. In those circumstances, I think it's very important to keep in mind the higher principle of the laws of war, which, as I've already said, is really balance military necessity with humanitarian responsibility. Now, I agree. The exploding pages were not booby traps and they were not war crimes. Actually, they were narrowly targeted. This we know. Who had those beepers and the walkie-talkies? They were purchased by Hezbollah for ranking operatives within the ranks of Hezbollah. You couldn't purchase these in the Lebanon equivalent of Walmart, right? They were distributed by Hezbollah for Hezbollah fighters. The children who tragically were injured or killed by the exploding beepers grabbed their fathers, their parents, their uncles' beeper when they heard them go off. Now we should also take into account, as we're assessing this matter, what alternatives Israel faced against these members of a militia whose stated purpose is the destruction of the state of Israel. Now, we know, Dan, you probably give the precise numbers, but I believe that when American forces fought in the cities of Iraq, Fallujah, Mosul, the ratio of civilians to fighter deaths was something like, for every one fighter killed, 5, 6, 7 civilians might have been injured. In the case of the exploding beepers, and again, I emphasize, everyone who had one had to be a Hezbollah operative. Hezbollah purchased them, Hezbollah distributed them. The kill ratio was something like, for every 3,000 member operatives taken out, one or two civilians were injured or killed. In the annals of fighting terrorism, the protection of civilians, the narrowness of the targeting, I think is all but unprecedented. The destruction to civilian infrastructure was practically zero. You had to be within a radius of about a foot and a half to be injured. And as far as the benefit, Israel knocked out of service 3,000, Hezbollah operatives in a single operation. So I think it's actually hard to find an operation that was more narrowly targeted against terrorists who hide among civilians, that caused less destruction of civilian infrastructure and resulted in fewer injuries or deaths to civilians. So for those reasons, I think we need to know more, I think. But from what we know so far, I do think the Israelis acted within the laws of war and should be congratulated for the operation. Mm.
And to your point about ratios, I don't have those exact figures, but certainly it's difficult. It's very, having served as an infantry officer, it's very difficult to do operations cleanly. It is a challenge. Diane, maybe first let me ask you, if there's anything incremental you'd add on the beepers, and if not, we'll shift topics.
Not at this point. I mean, like I said, right, much of the argumentation that's being made here is based on facts that are known and facts that are disputed. So I guess wearing my lawyer's hat here, a lot of the caution here on my end with reserving judgment is until facts are established. It's hard to make a summary conclusion that this was automatically either a violation or not a violation. The one thing I will say, though, is that to the extent that the asymmetric warfare, you know, warfare that's being conducted when the usual categories of combatant and civilian are being glossed over, it does not, and it's part of the paradox of living in the international system that we have it, which requires us to observe treaty obligations. It does not exonerate one party's failure to observe international law, does not create any excuse or justification for another party to also not fulfill their obligations. Then it enters into another realm of, can they do permissible countermeasures? Are these countermeasures, because the other state is breaching international law, are these countermeasures also permissible within international law? Again, that's a characterization that's so fact intensive, but that can help to sort of structure how we think about how we discharge our obligations as close as possible, notwithstanding the abject noncompliance of other parties.
So let's shift then to another topic, which is the targeted killing of leadership. As was mentioned earlier, Hassan Nasrallah, the longtime leader of Hezbollah, was killed in an Israeli airstrike south of Beirut last September. And Israel acknowledged that Nasrallah was the target of the strike. He was intended to be killed. And even more sensationally, Ismail Haniyeh, who is a senior Hamas leader, was killed while staying within an Iranian government compound in Tehran, also last year. So, Diane, coming back to the law here, what are the legal dynamics involved when determining whether and how to target senior leaders of an adversary who seem to have maybe both political and military functions? How should that be thought of? And were these men in particular legitimate military targets in your view?
So historically, at least in various military manuals, there's been sort of a prohibition against giving excess attention to senior officers, say in the military, when it comes to the conduct of hostilities. That's changed over time with respect to the characterization we have of combatants vis-a-vis persons directly participating in hostilities. With respect to political leaders, they shouldn't be targeted just because they're political leaders. The case still has to be made with respect to the military necessity for targeting these individuals. What's the military necessity? And again, how do you distinguish? How do you ensure proportionality? And how do you ensure precautions while planning this attack, right? But these two persons are quite unique, because Nasrallah at least we have the benefit of a 2006, say, UN Commission of Inquiry report that made it very clear, first and foremost, that the conflict that it was investigating at the time between Hezbollah and Israel was actually an international armed conflict between Lebanon and Israel. And Nasrallah was already involved at that time. They made a characterization that the political leaders of Hezbollah actually did not just have political functions, but also discharged continuous combat functions. So they were leaders that had some authority to control operations and tactical sort of decision making in regard to the conduct of hostilities. And if they are those persons, even if they technically, you know, don't wear a uniform in the way that we would understand combatants to be, they could be at least seen as either members of an organized armed group or persons directly participating in hostilities. So as to whether or not they could have been targeted, at least in the particular factual circumstances that we had from October 8 to the specific targeting, the particular choice of those targets, I think it's quite clearly established that these two were persons directly participating in the hostilities.
And Peter, anything you'd add on these two individuals or the topic more broadly of targeted strikes on senior leaders?
I'd just like to underscore what Dan says about Nasrallah and observation about Hezbollah. Hezbollah began as a militia. It became a political party only secondarily in Lebanon. But Nasrallah always remained head of both, certainly head of the militia. He was killed while he was in his command and control bunker located in the suburbs of southern Beirut. But in his case, there's no question as to his status as head of a militia, giving orders, hiring and firing generals and others of lower rank. So I think he easily fits within the laws of war, permission to target military leaders who are directly involved in conflict.
Right. So I'll just remind the audience here, we already have a couple questions that have come in, but after this next question, we're going to open it up to audience questions. So feel free to enter those into the question and answer function in Zoom. But before we do that, Peter, I'd like to ask you to help us just understand the path forward. So the IDF invaded southern Lebanon in October last year of 2024. And after reaching the Litani River, a ceasefire was signed. Meanwhile, just in the last few months, a civil war in neighboring Syria reignited. The Assad regime collapsed, which had been in place for decades, resulting in Israeli operations in parts of Syria, as well as the rise to power of Ahmed al-Sharia, who was an al-Qaeda Iraq commander, was formerly known as Abu Muhammad al-Jilani, with reference to the disputed Golan Heights. So there's a lot going on in the region, I think it's safe to say. So another difficult task then to end on, Peter, can you tell us what's likely to happen from here? How have the regional power dynamics changed since the conflict erupted, and what are the prospects for peace going forward?
Hard questions. Let's start with where we stand today. Regional power dynamics have definitely changed. And in fact, we ought to be understanding Israel's battle with Lebanon, the ceasefire into which Israel entered with Lebanon not long ago, as one of seven arenas in an Iran-backed war against Israel. What are the seven arenas? They are, we'll start up with Lebanon, then going east, Syria, Iran itself, Yemen in the south, Hamas in Gaza Strip, and Hamas in the West Bank or Judea and Samaria. So let's take each of those seven fronts to evaluate where things stand today. Yes, Hezbollah has been dealt a devastating blow. Of the 150,000 or so rockets and missiles they possessed on October 7th, maybe as much as 80% have been destroyed by Israeli air attacks. By the way, that means they still have in the neighborhood of 20 to 30,000 rockets and missiles. They haven't vanished, and they lost thousands of fighters. The Syrian regime, which was also part of the Iranian axis of resistance, under Assad, no longer exists. However, it's been replaced by a Sunni militant regime. They claim to have moderated, but the leader, Jolani, still has ambitions to create a Sharia supremacist state. I left out Iraq. Iraq is still relatively quiet and distant from Israel. Iran itself has suffered heavy blows from Israel. After two massive aerial assaults on Israel, one in April, one in October, both involving 300 or so missiles, ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, also drones, almost all of which were shot out of the sky by Israel and by friends assisting Israel, not least the United States, but also Britain. Also, aid came from moderate Arab states. After all that, Israel did undertake a strike on Iran in late October. To do this, Israeli jets had to fly more than 1,000 miles and come back. All the jets came back safely. The strike destroyed most of Iran's air defenses and destroyed Iran's capacity to produce ballistic missiles. This means that Iran right now and probably for a year or two is quite vulnerable to follow up Israel attacks. Those air defenses, of course, were protecting its nuclear sites. The Houthis in Yemen have declared that they will not fire on Israel as of the ceasefire with Hamas. Right now, we're headed for stage two of the ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas. Several months ago, I would have said that Israel had achieved two of its war aims in Gaza, namely destroying Hamas's ability to govern and destroying Hamas's ability to wage war. But even with the ceasefire, as some of the hostages, which was a third war aim of Israel, the return of the hostages, even as we see a few hostages returning, we also see Hamas recruiting to its ranks. Reports are 10 to 15,000 new fighters, which puts the future into question. So if we take things as a whole, over the last 15 months since the October 7th massacres, and especially during the last 6 months, Israel has accomplished amazing things on the battlefield, in the urban areas of Gaza, in Lebanon, in Iran, elsewhere in the Middle East. It has come at a very high price. The death and destruction in Gaza is a humanitarian crisis. I myself think that presumptively the moral and legal responsibility for the death and destruction in Gaza presumptively is on Hamas, because it was Hamas that chose first to attack Israeli civilians and second to embed its military operations in, among, and under Gaza's civilian population. But still, humanitarian crisis is a humanitarian crisis. Iran still remains equipped with thousands of missiles. According to most recent reports, Iran is on the cusp of producing a nuclear weapon. So I think it is incumbent upon us all to hope and pray for peace and stability in the Middle East, but not to expect it anytime soon.
Okay, well, with that, we'll turn to questions from the audience. And the first one we have is from Sylvia Ross, who asks, I'll just maybe summarize here a little bit as I read it, points out this problem, the theme that both of you identified during the panel, which was the difference between the standard that's being followed by both parties, right? So you say, isn't a primary problem of evaluating these conflicts that the West's failure to understand a Quranic concept of warfighting or Sharia-driven concept of warfighting is different. If groups like Hezbollah know the Western concepts of law of war and exploit that knowledge, how should the West respond? And maybe kind of implicit in that question is our adherence to these moral principles, is it a strength or a weakness in the West?
So maybe I could just interject at this point, because there seems to be a presumption that the laws of war were entirely crafted by the West. Quite the contrary. In fact, there was an overwhelming number of Muslim states that were part of the drafting of the initial conventions and the elaboration of the additional protocols 1 and 2 with respect to the Geneva Conventions. So the notions of distinguishing between combatants and civilians, preventing superfluous injury or unnecessary suffering, or proportionality, they're not tethered to a specific hemisphere or to a specific region in the world. There's astonishing consensus among all states that those methods are required in order to protect civilians in times of the use of force. Now, the question as it's posed actually takes us back to, what do we do with asymmetric warfare? One approach has been to say, let's discard the laws of war with people who won't observe it. The logic of that is, if nobody observes obligations, I shouldn't feel myself constrained. That is an extremely slippery and dangerous slope that brings the world ever closer to war. We've seen what wars of attrition, unrestricted war, can do, which is precisely why these regulations, these treaties, this body of expectations of professional conduct in pursuing military necessity, this is why this all evolved, precisely because if there were no restraints and if law were not to operate at all in war, we would have unrestrained warfare and disaster and destruction with no limits. But of course, there's a fairness question to that. Is it fair for the treaty abiding party to have to deal with this? I can only say this is the onus of a state that chooses to be part of that system. There's a price for not choosing to be part of that system, which is rules can be made without your input. Maybe for those who see, such as Israel or the United States, that certain rules have to be changed, they might want to be more active players in driving the rules of change rather than abandoning any form of rules whatsoever. But that's just some thought on asymmetric warfare.
Dan, if I may?
Please.
A couple quick observations, and I mostly do agree with Diane. First observation, I believe the two largest concentrations of lawyers studying the laws of war are in the Pentagon in the United States and in the Israeli equivalent. I believe that American soldiers and Israeli soldiers have trained into them an appreciation for the laws of war, partly for reasons Diane mentioned, that adherence to the laws of war is what distinguishes us, rights protecting democracies from our adversaries. I agree that the laws of war are intended for everybody, but it has to be added, I think, that specifically Hamas and specifically Hezbollah aim to use the international laws of war, the law of armed conflict, against the West and specifically against Israel and the United States, precisely because they know that we care about honoring the laws of war. And finally, I want to say, it seems to me that the laws of war, fairly interpreted, do have enough flexibility for Israel, for the United States to honor them while dealing with terrorists, in part because the laws of war recognize that when a party to a conflict chooses to operate within a civilian area, that party effectively transforms the civilian area into a battle zone. Now, still, the other side is obliged to do what's in its power to minimize civilian casualties. But the laws of war do not require Israel to go home. They do not require Israel to put down its arms when Hamas, for example, builds a terror tunnel network of 500 miles or so under the cities and urban areas of Gaza. It does require Israel, to the extent possible, to find ways to minimize the damage, but it recognizes that collateral damage will be inevitable. So there is flexibility built into the laws of war, and whether Israel or the United States is honoring obligations is, as Diane said early on, a very fact-intensive investigation. And for the most part, in regards not only in regard to activities in Lebanon, but for sure in regard to Hamas, most of those facts, not least Israeli rules of engagement, are not known to the people who are making judgments. And if I may add, that includes judges on the International Criminal Court who have issued arrest warrants for Prime Minister Netanyahu and former Defense Minister Yoav Gallant.
And we touched on that last topic you mentioned, Peter, at our Federalist Society National Convention. And Diane was kind enough to speak on a panel and weigh in on that and other issues with respect to the ICC. Next question is from Kennedy Brown, who is an applicant to law school. And Kennedy's question is specific to the U.S., but I think could also be generalized, which is, how much weight should we expect states to actually place in their actions on the norms of international law when we observe the conduct of nations in the world that we live in? How much should we expect international law to influence the determinations they make?
It's a great question. I actually would say we are past the point of thinking of whether or not international law exists, but we are at the point where states are making very calculated decisions about whether or not to efficiently breach international law and then live with the consequences. So the standard response I give to this is there is law and all states participate in the making of that law and in the implementation of that law within their respective jurisdictions, but not all states participate in the enforcement of that law. So many ways in which you can enforce international law, one of which I mentioned earlier in this panel, countermeasures. If people really wanted a particular state to come back to compliance with international law, states could devise their own countermeasures to induce that rule breaker to come back to compliance. But not everybody does that. It's not obligatory to create countermeasures. And only a few states have been willing to do that with respect to obvious mass atrocities that are taking place. There's a moral cost, but as well a legal cost to states that are selectively enforcing international law. Because when that happens, everybody's sort of negotiating in the shadow of knowing these are our expectations of what international law prescribes, what kind of legal accountability we could incur. But if there is no clear and coherent response, for example, that demands accountability for these violations of international law, you can have a world of violations and yet no people held accountable for it. So I do think that states today, as well as non-state actors, operate in the shadow of knowing what international law is, knowing to a certain degree they participate in it, but they're counting on arbitraging the gap between the existence of international law and who's willing to pay the price to really enforce it. And that's why we have so many of the situations we're facing today, especially with the ongoing continuing implementation of the ceasefire agreement, which hasn't been fully implemented, and hostages, which is also hostage taking being one of the most serious international crimes, also has not been punished yet.
Dan, if I may, again, I largely agree and want to emphasize a particular point. The laws of war, as I've said a couple of times now, really do involve balancing questions of military necessity and humanitarian responsibility. I believe a lot of problems arise in the United States, also in Europe, because people do not take that balancing test necessary, don't take that balancing test seriously. We have lots of experts on humanitarian responsibility. We have very few experts weighing in public debate. In the Pentagon, we do, but in public debate, including at the law schools, who are experts in military necessity. So to the law student who asked about the application of the laws of war to war, war is a nasty business, but respect for individual dignity, respect for individual rights is part of the American tradition. Laws of war in part grow out our commitment to the laws of war. The American commitment in part grows out of our traditions, which is a human rights tradition, even though, as Diane rightly points out, the international laws of war are intended to elicit support and receive backing from peoples and nations around the world. So here's what's important today, I think. It's very important for coming generations of students of war and law to ensure that they have studied both sides of this balancing test. In applying the international laws of war, law of armed conflict, we do need experts in humanitarian responsibility. But you cannot apply the laws of war fairly or responsibly unless you also make yourself an expert in military necessity. That means studying security, strategy, and military history. All that's necessary, in my judgment, to honor the imperatives of the laws of war, which we should do.
It's a fantastic call to action and one that will resonate with the studious members of the Federalist Society, Peter. So thank you, Peter. Thank you, Diane, for joining us. And we'll turn it back over to Carolyn.
Great. Well, thank you all so much. This has been terrific. Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our speakers for the benefit of their time and expertise today. Thank you also to the audience members who joined us and asked questions. Check out our website, fedsoc.org, or follow us on all major social media platforms at FedSoc to stay up to date with announcements and upcoming webinars. Thank you once more for tuning in. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.